You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsom.
Yes, welcome again to yet another Physics Ed Podcast. Big week this week, like always, but this one's particularly special if you love gamification and education. We're speaking with Claire Selden, who is a seriously cool teacher who really knows her stuff when it comes to gamification. Now, she is a former science, history and technology teacher and lately has been working as a learning designer with the New South Wales Department of Education. And she's got a fair bit of ICT history and she uses that background to create digital learning teaching resources for students to use in their classroom. And in her own words, she uses a nerdy gamer experience to create and educate all things about gamification. She's seriously good at it. And she has a lot of fun. And you'll really tell in this interview, she's having a blast doing it. Seriously. So enjoy this interview. I certainly love speaking with Claire. And I hope you get a bit out of it.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast.
I am a former IT second level tech support who went back to school to become a science high school teacher. I did that for a while in an odd but fabulous Montessori high school. And then I moved to the New South Wales Department of Education and I'm a learning designer. And I guess you don't know what that means because when I got the job, I literally didn't know what it meant either. And I got to work my first day and thinking, what have I signed up for? Learning designers create digital teaching resources and professional learning. And I'm really lucky because a lot of my colleagues have to create professional learning for teachers around things that's not necessarily in their interests area. But I mostly focus on digital teaching resources for students. And a lot of the time I get to do things around STEM and science in general, but also maths in the primary area. We try and make sure that anything that we do integrates literacy and numeracy so that it's as cross-curricular as possible and a teacher can choose to do that activity. Because if you're not ticking off literacy and numeracy outcomes in a primary, particularly project-based learning thing, then you just, the teacher says, well, how can I justify doing that?
Makes sense. And just sort of just crossing my mind just then, and just, you're in IT and you jump to teaching. I guess straight up, why the jump?
Well, I was working in IT in the late 90s and it was around the Y2K period. Oh. And it's better now, but back then, there were mostly men. And I got a job working at an internet advertising company and I worked very hard and I got a raise after 3 or 6 months. I'd proved myself. And then they were big, they were growing because this was just before the bubble crash. And they hired a 19-year-old who knew nothing and they hired him at the same salary as me and they expected me to teach him everything I knew, and then he was part of the boys club and I got asked to clean the monitor by the marketing manager and I didn't like that very much.
Oh, so, why Claire, why would you not like that? That's crazy. I can't believe
I don't know,
who would have thought,
you know? I was miserable actually. Yeah, and I quit and I didn't do anything for a little while because I jumped around a lot. When I finished school, I actually went to uni to do psychology. I did that for a year and a half and I hated it. And then I got work in IT. I worked for CompuServe, internet service provider. I worked for Macquarie University doing second level tech support for the biology department. And I enjoyed that. It was male dominated, but the university wasn't quite as sexist. A lot of the biology professors were women. But when I went out into sort of the industry, it was just a bit, it wasn't great.
Yeah.
In the end, I decided,
No, I just think it makes a lot of sense. Like deciding to move into teaching. I mean, one thing is that you can kind of change that even mindset for people right from the start before they enter the industry, because eventually these kids eventually are going to be bosses at some point. It seems a logical step.
Yes. Yes. Well, but also I needed to do a job that mattered. Some aspects of IT were a bit soul destroying. You could work really, really hard and nothing you did was visible. And nobody cared. Like if you did a good job, nobody cared. If you did a bad job, everyone yelled at you. Whereas teaching, it so visibly matters. Like at the end of a year, you can look at each student and, you know, their progress, maybe some student may have less progress than another, but you can be proud that you helped them achieve that and move forward. And after a few years, I was very fortunate, the school that I was at, that we had quite close mentoring relationships with the students because it was such a small cohort. And, you know, you see a student in year seven and they're all, you know, and then they go into year eight, year nine, and you're pushing back and, you know, no, have some boundaries. And then year 10, they blossom and you're like, oh, I can see the adult that you're becoming. And I love that. I absolutely adored being allowed to be part of that process.
Oh, it was wonderful. And actually, you got to see that in two different forms of education, Montessori, and it was the standard public school system you went into, or was it a different independent school? What was your
No, it's a private Montessori school.
Okay.
Cool. So I actually never taught in the public system.
Okay.
Didn't work. I work for the government now, but not as a teacher.
Yeah.
I taught just at that school.
And so roll that forward. You are working in government and very much a big fan of education and STEAM and everything else. So, I guess it's, for me, I'm just still trying to get my head around. Describe what's like on an average week in the middle of the school year sort of area. Like what do you sort of get up to?
Okay, well, so I look after a bunch of different projects. So I'll give you an example of what I'm working on now.
Yep.
So I am finishing a project for year 10 students on the Western Front. It's basically we got together with the Australian, not the Australian War Memorial, the Hyde Park War Memorial, they have a historian, Brad Manera, who's a genius, and we made a series of videos. He went over to EPA with the Premier's Award, PAM, I can't remember what it stands for. Basically, every year students apply to go on an overseas trip to somewhere where Australian veterans have fought, and they ride, do a big history essay. It's a pretty amazing experience, and because it's the centenary of World War One, they've been going to the Western Front for 4 years. And so last year, Brad Manera went with a videographer, and they shot a whole bunch of footage around Ypres and the Western Front. And so I got to turn that footage and archival footage and images into a series of videos. And then I've created a project-based learning sort of unit of work, guiding students through the World War One topic in Stage 5 history. That isn't particularly gamified or STEM orientated, yeah. But what I have tried to do is really closely integrate the use of technology. So there's a lot of use of Google Earth and Google Maps to try and help the kids situate what they're learning within the real topography, because that was a big thing in World War One over in the Western Front, because everything's so flat. They got some drone footage. They actually got drones to fly at the height that the aircraft flew in World War One, which is disturbingly close to the ground, I might add.
You're
right. And so we turned that into videos, and then I wrote lesson plans to go with each video that are sort of form, so a teacher could just do, you know, one video and lesson with the kids, or if you did all five, it's a sequence of work. And the end is sort of about focusing the students on the veterans in their area. And one of the things that's quite cool is that we've lost a bunch of war memorials. So there's war memorials, especially to World War One, all over New South Wales that aren't registered anywhere. So the people in the community know they exist, but there's the RSL have a database and they're slowly trying to add things. And so one of the suggested options for a final activity is that the kids actually go and shoot some 360 images or video and submit it up to Google Earth or Google Maps so that their war memorial is on the map.
Very well.
So that's one of the projects I'm doing, which is pretty cool. Another project I'm doing is working with the Royal Botanic Gardens, making a virtual reality bushwalk. I'm so excited about this. So this is really STEM and gamification. So basically what I've done is we went out to the bush. They've got at Mount Annan, they have a tiny bit of remnant, very endangered Cumberland Plains woodland ecosystem. It contains all these species that don't exist anywhere else in Australia, let alone the world. And the idea is that as part of the science syllabus, that students need to explore and compare ecosystems. And one of the things we try and do in the department is create equity for rural and remote students. So the idea is that not every student in New South Wales can go to Mount Annan and see this ecosystem. But if they go through my VR, then they will have that. The VR doesn't work in Vive or HTC because I tried to make it sort of a bit more of a, like a, do you know the games Myst or Riven?
Yes.
It's kind of like you go on a bit of a wander, and I've tried to make it as non-linear as possible. So each panorama that you go into has all these little question marks, and you don't know what you're going to find when you click on it. You might find a plant, you might find an insect, you might find a bird or an animal, you might find a bit of just sort of more the abiotic features. So there's a dam, and I've got a log, and talking about the importance of logs as habitat, that sort of thing. We've also embedded some videos in it. We recorded sound out there, so when you play it on the big screen, it's quite immersive, and it gives the students the opportunity to discover the way they would if they went on an excursion. Because one of the problems I find with a lot of virtual reality stuff is that it's very linear. It's like you go here and then you do this and then you do that. But in real life, students don't have to do that. They can make decisions, and it's one of the things about gamification that students find engaging is precisely that when you play a game, you have choices. You always have choices, and those choices have consequences. And so in this, the choices are about what you look at, what order you look at, and you don't know what you'll find. So there's a bit of mystery in that. The consequences aren't very, they're not negative consequences. The consequences is you find a cool thing and then you learn a bit about it. And then the next step was that I wanted to work out how to make it a bit more immersive. So I found an app that lets me map a video game controller, like a console game, PS4 controller, to my laptop so that when I'm running the VR on my laptop, I can actually control and navigate it not by a mouse but by a video game controller. So when you put it onto the big screen, the person can stand in front of it and it sort of feels like they're moving through it. It's pretty awesome. I'm excited for that.
I can hear there's some great projects there. Even just thinking like overlaying AR into even the World War One stuff. I mean, I was just imagining you could almost have the drones run, almost emulate the sorties that would have been flown over the cliffs and all the rest of the place. But also whilst they're flying along, then you could actually put up the imagery of really old scenes that happen at time and place, depends if there's any historical photos that actually show that. I mean, just looking at how the topography changed versus it's cool, and what you're saying about the Australian Botanic Garden, that is a fantastic site. I'm very, very familiar with it. We actually run holiday science programs there every year, every term.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing it at the Australian Plant Bank. I can never say that. Australian
Plant. I love the Australian Plant Bank. How cool is that place?
Oh, it's a brilliant place, and frankly, very well not discovered. Not many people realize that you've got this awesome place, which is, it's basically like our national seed vault. So think of seeds that have been tucked away. So if something goes down in the ecosystem, we can hopefully reboot it using genetic material that's being conserved. But we're talking a multi-million dollar installation, and it does actually have some exhibits within the foyer and through this, and they actually can run visitations and all the rest. And it's just not well known that it's even there.
No, and I couldn't recommend it more for teachers to take their students out there. They do all sorts of really cool stuff there. And they let me and my photographer actually go into the freezer. That was pretty cool. I would. That's something I would like to do at some point. We were thinking after I finish this project. I mean, it's. There's so many different things. I'm very spoiled. My boss is very willing to let me get overexcited about ideas. So one of the, I'd like to work with the Sydney Botanic Gardens in the CBD to make some kind of AR excursion, so that when the kids arrive, you give them a set of iPads with an app loaded in, maybe Metaverse, not 100% sure because I haven't really done any work on it. And then instead of giving them a worksheet and saying, okay, go and find this plant, you sort of lead them on a bit of an AR treasure hunt around the gardens. I think that would be so cool. I'd love to do some kind of 360 video sort of look at how the journey of a seed from gathering all the way to the freezer. That would be really cool. I think students don't get to see behind the scenes. And sometimes it's like they don't know what jobs are available and cool things they could do as scientists, because stuff gets tucked away in labs, or like you said, cool stuff is happening and nobody knows anything about it. So
and that's one of the something like that. Communication, like that's trying to get it out there, and we people like ourselves and, you know, the radio host and all the rest can only say so much, but to be honest, I just see the schools as a way of distributing that knowledge, you know, face to face to the students themselves. Like that is exactly the point. I mean, in getting something like, I mean, you said it's all about equity for the regional and remote students, so they can come and visit those sites. That's awesome. But I also think those kids in the inner West Sydney, or maybe they're in Northern Melbourne or whatever, they, you know, they have access to sites, but they may actually not have the chance to go to jump on a bus, because frankly, the buses cost too much. It just do, and
yes,
unless
it's true,
yeah, the buses kill it. They do. They absolutely do. I mean, that's one of the things that we do is visiting to schools. I never like the word incursion, but it's what it said. Going to visit a school means you don't have to have this cost of a bus. it's the bus that
hurts. Yes, and it does make a huge difference, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things that my team at the department is associated with is the DART Connections program, which I find that's really, really awesome. And Physics Ed does stuff with them as well, I believe.
Yes,
you run remote and virtual excursions that way. And that's the same thing. Like when you think about the money and the time and effort and energy that goes into planning a single excursion, you know, it's a lot of work for the parents sometimes to come up with that extra $40 or $50. And then, you know, the teachers, all the paperwork for the teacher and all sorts of, I mean, you know, people who aren't teachers who don't have to fill in all the paperwork, maybe they think, oh, you're being crazy. It's like, no. And if there are people from organizations listening, a good risk assessment that the teacher can read through and doesn't have to rewrite is a fine thing if you want people to come to your organisation.
Oh, absolutely. Step by step.
But anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
But those regional and remote things, I mean, that's what virtual excursions, AR, VR can do, is completely give the chance of these kids to 100% experience the stuff that they can't experience physically in location because, hey, they're in remote areas. It, the learning is still the same. I mean, yeah, of course, I mean, people can come out to those schools. In fact, yes, we certainly do. But, I mean, often, unless they've got particular funding because they're in remote areas, or if you band schools together, then that's a thing. Like, we actually sit in the Snowy Mountains where you get schools do a once every 2 year camp where they all camp in the school, which I think is just cool, by the way. So they all camp that overnight. Cool. And obviously, you've got all the risk assessments around that because it's a whole other level when kids are sleeping over there anyway. Experience it, but they're pooling your resources. But, this is fun. I mean, you're really just having fun. I mean, Bethesda would actually like, so in case they've ever done a Bethesda's a software studio that makes a whole bunch of things like Skyrim and all that sort of stuff. And the fact that you're creating
amazing games.
Yeah, open learning environments. And then in a way, I mean, the budgets behind that are way bigger. But that's sort of what you're trying to do.
Yes, it is. And in fact, Morrowind, still one of the best games I've ever played. So when I was thinking, so I'd done quite a lot of thinking and writing on gamification in the past couple of years. And I've always been a massive gamer. I'm a board gamer, card gamer. My parents played D&D in the 70s. Like, I'm a second generation hardcore nerd. Yeah. And I started to think about how do the games that I play and the things that I love about gaming, and you see your kids, it doesn't matter how unmotivated they are in your class, most of them will have a game that they play, if it's sport or a video game or whatever, and they'll love it and they'll know tons about it, like tons, way more than you want to know. And so part of what gamification is looking at how can you take that passionate, that interest and that learning and put it into a school environment. And so for me, the two really key things about gamification is discovery and story. So if you have a great story to hook your learning on that pulls the kids in, that engages them, that attaches them to the characters, whether they be scientists or even theories, like a theory can be a character, it's just about the story of that discovery or that idea or the ups and downs that something goes through to be where it is today. That's much more engaging than, you know, dot points. And similarly with discovery, the minute you say to the kids, go and find stuff out, come back and tell me what you think, as opposed to step one, step two, step three. And that's not to say that you don't need to do, you know, rote learning or like really simple stuff sometimes. You absolutely do. I think everything should be done in balance. But I don't think we give, because modern kids, it's not just in school where they don't get to make many choices or do things. I don't know about you, but when I was little, especially in the summer holidays, I'd go out in the morning, say bye to mum, take my roller skates and my swimmers, and I'd see her at the end of the day. And I was 11, 12. I was perfectly safe. I was just hanging around the neighbourhood. But kids these days, they're scheduled. After school, it's you do this, and then on holidays, you're on a camp, or your mum wants to know where you are every minute of every day. And they just don't get very much choice or chance to make decisions or change a variable and see what happens. And I think gamification is a way that we can bring that choice and agency for students back into the classroom.
Absolutely.
Same with STEM.
Well, it is. I mean, STEM's an avenue certainly for the makers of the world to explore their world, unbelievably so. But at the same point, the gamification does the same thing. I mean, we often talk about immersive environments and what does that actually mean. I kind of think in a lot of ways that a really well-constructed open learning environment in games is almost like planning out a novel, like and then some, because you know how you often have, you look at the novels and they've got characters and the characters have backstories and what's going on in the back end and everything else. And in some ways, and I'm going to flick it sort of another way, almost like the timelines of a Tarantino film. There's all this stuff just going on and you can explore it. I mean, in a movie or a novel, it's a linear fashion, turning the page or watching the movie. But in a game environment, it's different because you can explore yes. 3D space and you can either miss stuff completely because you never get to interact with said character or said environment because you never quite get there. Or you maybe don't yeah. explore those as quite as deep as you may explore others. But the beauty about it is the student agency, the kids who create the games can get as much detail as they want, but also the kids who play the games after the fact can
yes.
do what they want. It's cool.
Definitely. But it doesn't have to be a game. So I'll give you an example from Montessori philosophy. So the idea of the Montessori philosophy is that if you prepare the environment correctly, the student will interact with the environment as a learner, and you, the teacher, are a guide. So you're there, you're another resource in that space. And it's very, very clear in a 3 to 6, so 3-year-olds to 6-year-olds, stage one Montessori classroom, where the room is full of stuff, cool things, and each one of those things has a way of interacting with it. And the child gets taught how to interact with those activities or learning objects or whatever it is. But when they come in the morning, they can choose out of all the activities they've been taught how to use, they just choose one. And then they'll go and sit down and set it up and have a go. And they could do it 20 times or they can do it once. And that's completely up to them. They choose when they go to the bathroom. They choose when they want to have snack. And when they want to have snack, they go and get a real knife and a real plate and a real piece of fruit. And they sit down and they cut it up for themselves. And when they finish, they take it back and they wash it up. And we're talking 3-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that idea of the prepared environment is expanded. So in the high school environment, when you're doing a project-based learning unit of work, what you have to do a huge amount of work before the project. You have to, like a game design, yeah? You have to think about all the different things that the students might want to do and how you can prepare for that and how you can have the classroom set up so that there's things that attract their interest. It might be a poster, it might be a model, the different experiments. And obviously you also have to meet the syllabus outcomes. So there's a certain number of prepared explicit lessons that you would give them, but you also need to be prepared for the fact that the students might go off on a tangent and then you have to work out, okay, well, how can I deliver the learning that they need to understand that to them? And it might be a short little one-on-one thing where you just explain something to them, or you might go and find some books and put them in the classroom for them to access on their own. So a really cool example of this was when we built, I was doing a unit on hydroponics, and the goal of the project was to set up a greenhouse, fill it with hydroponics, and grow some food. everything that could go wrong did go wrong. So we wrote to Bunnings and asked them to donate us a greenhouse, which they did. And then we built it and discovered that it was missing a piece. So we had to pull it back down, pack it up, send it off to them, ask them to send us another one, which they did. So we built that and the kids were moaning and groaning and grumbling. They had to build it twice, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they were a lot better the second time. They didn't pay attention to that bit, but I did. And then the next, we got it set up. It was all ready to go. And then there was a humongous storm. And it blew it down and broke a whole bunch of the wall struts. And it was just, so then we had to decide, well, how are we going to deal with this? We can't go back to Bunnings and say, hey, can we have another greenhouse? So we had to come up with a sort of makeshift structure under a veranda. And then we had to, so at every step, it was about them making decisions, them testing things, and me, I knew pretty much what we were going to do, so I'd ordered a whole bunch of equipment beforehand, but it wasn't me telling them this is what you have to do. What I said to them is, this is the equipment that you have. How are you going to use it? And it took all year, but at the end of term 4, we ate a salad that out of greens that we'd grown in our hydroponic setup, and it was delicious.
And I wonder how many kids, I'm not too sure when this happened, but I wonder if they've gone and built their own one at home. Because, I mean, the learning doesn't have to just happen in the school. I mean, they can repeat and refine and do it at home after the fact. I mean, which really means that they're
absolutely
not applying it, which is great. but I was actually just listening to that. I mean, a greenhouse blowing down when you need it is kind of an issue. You might need to fix it, and the kids can have to, you know, learn resilience and problem solving, all that sort of stuff. I mean, I like it when kids go on a complete tangent. I was only just speaking with a fantastic teacher recently, Joanne Gattalita. She does a brilliant job with students, has done for many years down around the southern area of Sydney. She was recounting a story whereby she was doing a very simple project with some early years primary kids, whereby it was all about the weather. And so let's just make a rain gauge. Very very obvious thing that's meant to happen here. Problem is, it only works if it's raining. If it hasn't rained for 2 months, you have an issue. However, the kids thought, well, what if you just fill it up with water and you look at evaporation rates instead? That becomes a useful thing. Now it's now about relative humidity. Now you can actually track it in a way. I mean, obviously you could use a hygrometer because, you know, you can get those things, but not so much in primary school. You're not always going to have that. But they were able to twist the outcome to suit their needs. Well, actually, no, to be honest, the outcome was still there. They just did it in a different way.
As a teacher, you really do need to be flexible for that. You need to be able to say, okay, this isn't going to work, and sometimes if the kids are bored. I have in the middle of a lesson looked at everyone and gone, okay, hands up who's bored. Everyone's hand goes up. My hand goes up. It's like, this isn't working. Let's, you know, an experiment didn't work, or I had a really cool idea about something and it just hasn't happened. So then it's like, okay, well, this is what we have to learn. It's in the syllabus. In my case, I pretty much think most of the things in the science syllabus are actually worth learning. How can we figure this out? How can we make this more interesting? Can we go outside? Can we run around? Can we build something? Can we poke something with the stick and see what happens?
Yeah.
And when you ask them, how could we learn or explore this thing? They come up with the most amazing answers. Really just, yeah.
No, they really
I couldn't recommend that more. Teachers often struggle, and I know I did, giving control to the students in the classroom, standing back and seeing what they can do. I think that's a big part of what makes STEM so awesome, and it's certainly a big part of gamification. Like, if you have gamified an activity, and it doesn't have to be an actual game, yeah, it can just be a teaching activity that has elements of story that gives the students discovery or competition or whatever. But you need to be able to let go, because when they play video games, you're not micromanaging their every move. Or when you play a board game, you know, either it's every person for themselves or you're working together for a common good rather than letting them, you know, like dictating their every action.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's, it doesn't work. They will tune out. They're much more engaged when they have say and control and a chance to express themselves.
So educators everywhere listening on this. I was just thinking here, like, obviously you're incredibly passionate, well, frankly, about a lot of things, which is awesome.
Pretty much everything, which
is awesome, and I love to hang out with people like that. It's very cool. And there'll be some people going, right, so cool. So I want to go down this gamification route. Let's give it a bit of a go, and I want to give it a bit of a STEM twist, but it doesn't have to be STEM. It could be in any area, but hey, there's a STEM podcast effectively, so why not? Let's do STEM. So they go, you know what? I want to give it a go. I want to, you know, do some gamification with my students. And it doesn't matter what year group for now. We don't have to go down to that level. Just sort of wondering, what sort of first steps? Just say you had some teachers in front of you. You're doing a learning design chat with them. And what do you think is at least the best way to at least start off planning out a unit of work? So it's end of 2018 right now. They're planning out some work so that some point in early 2019, something happens in their school that is gamified. I mean, what are some loose things they should be looking at as they create this thing that might happen?
So I would start by thinking about how you want to gamify it. So do you want to make it a competition? Do you want it to have a story? Do you want the students to go on a bit of a discovery journey? I really hate rewards and competition. That's just not really my style. But for some students, that works for them. It's engaging and it matters. So from that point of view, do you want them to create something? So most games involve creation and problem solving. So you want to sort of think about what you want and the students to get out of that gamified experience. A lot of these you can deliver through a STEM unit or a project-based learning unit. There are teachers who gamify their entire classroom and everything about their classroom is part of a huge sort of fantasy or sci-fi game, which I find super awesome. But that's a lot of work and probably not the best place to start. One of the ways you could do is say, you know what, kids hate the maths worksheets we do first thing in the morning. How can we gamify that? And there's very simple ways of making, you could do something where you create a story around them. So in somehow finishing a certain number of sheets correctly in a certain number of times has an impact on the story. I actually did a presentation on this at the Manswa conference this year. I wasn't very happy with it. It didn't quite go as I'd hoped. But the idea of using a story so the problems that the students are doing are related in some way to the story, or it's the way that they move the story forward. You could do something like take an activity that's quite cerebral and try and find a way of making it hands-on or having the students move around. I've done some really cool stuff with particle theory, which students often find quite difficult to understand, and I just got them to run around the hall and played a sort of silly game of tip tag, but it was about what the temperature was like, and depending on what the temperature was like depended on how fast or slow they could move, because particle theory. But if you want to do sort of problem solving or discovery, then you need to think bigger. You need to be doing sort of a project based. So I'll give you an example. Year 11 chemistry. When I was a prac teacher, I taught year 11 chemistry. And they were doing the forensics unit as their option, and I got to introduce it to them. So what I did was I took the Lindy Chamberlain murder and I made it into a mini role-playing game. So I got a map, and this is a group of kids. I don't think any of them had ever played a role-playing game before, so it had to be quite simple. But I got a map, I got a whole bunch of the different evidence, and then I gave them a mini toolkit of the different forensic tools that they had access to at the time. And then I said to them, okay, as a class, you are the forensic examiners and you've just arrived at this campsite. And then I showed them the map and I said, so these are the people you can talk to. And it took them a little while, but then, you know, a couple of the braver ones figured it out and they're like, okay, well, we want to interview the mother and find out what she has to say. And I got a lot of the words from, you know, the police records and stuff, so it could be quite true to the story. They played a game, but they were also thinking, how does a forensic scientist work? They were exploring a real crime scene and all the real evidence that was there. at the time. And then they had to think about, well, you know, what tests could we do? What do we think will happen? In a very general way, because this was the introduction to the topic. And then, but then afterwards I talked to them about everything that had gone wrong and why and how she'd gone to jail, even though it's clear that from the actual evidence that the dingo ate the baby.
I love
and
how,
so then we had a chance.
I was just thinking just then, because my brain's always everywhere. I love how we just got onto this story just as the sirens go past your home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the police did a pretty bodgy job in that case. And that, but that was part of, so when you look at the course, the syllabus for that option, a bunch of it was looking at how forensic equipment has changed over time and how we've gotten better at doing it. And also, you know, there's a bunch of ethical issues around that because, for example, the science behind it isn't always as sound as we like to think it is. Mm. So that one story was a really great way of getting the kids sort of clued in to all aspects of that topic. And I could have just told them the story, but it was so much more exciting and fun to have them game it out, essentially.
That's right. About this, if I had to boil it down to, apart from creating the steps in the game, it's really around context, isn't it? No context, no one cares about your game. Have context, now they care.
Yes. Yes. And you were talking before about writing a novel. And I guess that's the thing, when you're writing a gamified unit of work or even just a tiny little lesson, you need to be thinking, why will the kids care about this? And often it's about the story. And the more either the story is really shallow and brief and the idea is that the kids will create it over time, they will build it, which can be awesome, but it's not, that wouldn't work for every group. Otherwise you need to know what's happening. Like you said, with the video games, there may be stuff going on in the background that the kids never interact with, but you need to know it's there as the creator. But I suspect that might put some teachers off because they think, oh, I'm not creative, which I don't believe. I think everyone can be creative. But when you're trying to gamify an activity, you can start it small. It's just about thinking about the motivation. So yeah. Why is the kid doing this thing? And preferably not for rewards or visible achievement, although those are legitimate ways of gamifying something. But preferably to understand something or dig into something or make choices. I think, I know I've said this a few times, but teenagers in particular, they need practice making choices. And school is although it's high stakes for them emotionally, in terms of making dumb choices and not suffering really long-term consequences, and learning from them and hopefully not growing up and doing really stupid things, school is actually a relatively safe place to make dumb choices. And we need to give them that opportunity. And it's more work for us, but it's better for them in the long run. Or even just adding a bit of chance to something. So, you know, I know teachers sometimes use sort of choice boards or something where, you know, the students have a number of different ways they can practice a skill or demonstrate their understanding. But you can also use chance. So you give them a whole list of different options and then they roll a dice and they have to do what the dice rolls. And that can be really great if, especially actually stretching your gifted students who may know what they're good at and just keep, if they've got choice, they will often choose the thing that they're good at to keep looking good. Right. And you know, using chance to force them to stretch their wings a bit. But again, it should be in a low stakes thing where they're not going to have a meltdown because it turns out they've got to write a song or something that that would be my I'm so unmusical. The idea of having to you know, demonstrate my understanding of the periodic table by writing a song, but you know, it would stretch them. So I got sidetracked. I'm sorry.
No, I lost my train of thought. I actually like the idea. It is effectively a scaffold for them to learn and then branch out from. It makes sense. And I guess it comes down to as educators, how much risk aversion we have, or the exact opposite of that, I suppose. And eventually, yes. like everything, it all comes down to time. So it's my headspace is, as always with any project, is start small and put layers on like an onion. Just keep it growing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hopefully not like an onion where it makes you cry. But you'll get there.
Definitely not. Yeah, that sounds terrible.
But at the same point, I mean, I've run into bucket loads of teachers who have gone down the gamifying route, and it has worked for their classes. And I'm talking from year three through to grade 10s, that's all types of students in all different locations. And they'll happily describe where things have worked when they haven't, and it's just about having a go in the first place. And it's fantastic. Love it. So
one of the great things about gaming and gamification in general, right, is that most kids play games, and they're familiar with the idea of beta testing. So the thing that I always tell teachers is you say to the kids, this is in beta, which means it's not perfect and there are bugs, and I need your help to make it better. And then the kids automatically know that it's not a polished, finished product, and they feel a sense of excitement because they get to feed back to you, hey, this didn't work, or this was really cool, or here's a good idea for making it better. Yeah. And then you as a teacher, you don't need to be perfect because it's in beta.
And it's
it'll be better next time.
That's right. And it's still in an environment where we're not selling ranches. We're not impacting on, you know, their own as they grow as students, but that's our job in the first place. So it's okay.
Yes.
And as long as it doesn't chew up too much of your time, and maybe over time you might become one of those hyper over the top teachers have done this completely and totally flipped their classroom around, whereas everything's like that. It all depends on your style eventually and what you want to have out of it, which is fantastic. Hey Claire, how do people get in touch with you? Because I mean, obviously you've got a lot of stuff to do with this. I mean, I know that you've got a website filled with things with the title Teaching with Game, but how do they get onto that? How do they find you? How do they do that sort of stuff?
Well, the best way probably to find me is to find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is ClaireSeldon_ED, and there's a link to my website from there. But I do have, in case, I know not everyone loves Twitter, so I have a short URL, which is goo.gl/SJX. UF4. No, I don't sell anything on the website. There's no ads. I don't make any money at all from it. I don't have a book. I just found cool stuff, and I do update it. There's, if you want to like dip your toe in the water but not go crazy, there's advice on how to turn any worksheet into a simple gamified activity, and I actually gamified the process. So there's some random generators, so you can randomly generate a way of gamifying and a tool, so you know, dice or balls or whatever, and then you apply that to your worksheet and just give it a go. So it's very, very, very simple. There's a form you can email me from the website. I love giving people advice. I love having people ask my opinion. I just generally really, really keen on people doing cool stuff. So
absolutely. Definitely hit up Claire. And also when you're going on to Twitter, just make sure it's C-L-A-I-R-E. Because we have an ex-staff member who is C-L-A-R-E. So it's just a...
I have an I and I have an E. some people spell it with the I and no E. So
yeah.
C-L-A-I-R-E, S for Sam, E-L-D-O-N, underscore E-D.
Excellent. Hey, by the way, I do the S for Sam thing too with Newsom. I feel like I always, it's like I'm buying a vowel or a consonant from Wheel of Fortune sometimes.
Oh, that's so true. But people hear F if you don't.
Yeah, they do.
Discover.
Absolutely.
I get Claire Felden a whole bunch. S.
Those people are old enough to remember Australian politics a decade or two ago. Actually, it was 2 years. Gosh, it's getting on. There was a politician called Hewson, and I got a lot of Hewson at that time, which is
A long I remember him, John Hewson.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh dear. So that's a different game, which I don't think I ever want to get involved in at all, but happy to work along.
No, thank you.
But look, thank you very much, Claire, for your time. It's been fascinating to have a chat with you, and I love hanging out with you on Twitter doing stuff in the Primary STEM chat and all those sorts of things.
I highly recommend Primary STEM chat. It's amazing. And you don't need to be a primary school teacher. I'm not. I'm not even in the classroom, but it's just a fabulous group of people from all over the world, increasingly. It was mostly Australian to begin with, just sharing stuff that they've done that went well, but also stuff that didn't go well. I find you learn as much from people's mistakes, I think.
Absolutely. And actually, a couple episodes back, go listen to Rachel Lair, who's the founder of the thing, just talking about what she does.
She is so cool.
Yeah, does a very good job.
She is an awesome, awesome lady. So, so cool. Yeah, couldn't follow her on Twitter. She shares the coolest stuff.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, thank you very much. I should leave you be. I know that you've got games to create and people to design, learning outcomes and all that sort of stuff, and you're having fun doing it. That's the biggest thing out of all of it, is that it should be fun. And your students benefit from it. Should. Have a fantastic day.
Thanks very much, Ben.
You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. Why don't you book us for a science show or workshop in your school? We love seeing students get excited about science, and you will too. Go to physicseducation.com.au and click on schools for more info.
Well, there we go. We were just speaking with Claire Selden, who you can really tell is a fantastic educator. Seriously, it would have been awesome being in a class, I've got to admit. But she is having a blast and learning a lot about how to do learning design and spreading that knowledge right across New South Wales Department of Education and beyond through her many works with, you know, Twitter chats and speaking at all sorts of different conferences and things. She's very, very good at the gamification and learning design. Seriously. So if you want to check out more, jump on Twitter. Why not? And go find her, Claire Selden. So what you do is look up at Claire Selden underscore Ed. So that's spelled C-L-A-I-R. E-S-E-L-D-O-N underscore E-D. You'll find everything she's been up to lately, plus you'll get a link to her, quite a great blog about, gamification. It's called Teaching with Game. It's a bit of a long URL, so just go to her Twitter profile and just click on the shortened link she's got there, and you can find out all about what she's been doing and how she's been helping other educators. So that's enough from me, and I hope you've had a bit of fun this episode, and I look forward to catching up another time. All the best. You've been speaking with me, Ben Newsom from Phys Education, and you've been listening to the Phys Ed Podcast. Have a great one.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed Podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book, and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S. This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au